Chapter 2. Tales of the Hook. The dividing line between fantasy and science fiction, for properly speaking, fantasy is what it is, the horror genre is only a subset of the larger genre, is a subject that comes up at some point at almost every fantasy or science fiction convention held, and for those of you unaware of the subculture, there are literally hundreds each year. If I had a nickel for every letter printed on the fantasy SF dichotomy in the columns of the amateur magazines and the prozines of both fields, I could buy the island of Bermuda. It's a trap, this matter of definition, and I can't think of a more boring academic subject. Like endless discussions of breath units in modern poetry or the possible intrusiveness of some punctuation in the short story, it is really a discussion of how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. Not really interesting unless those involved in the discussion are drunk or graduate students. Two states of roughly similar incompetence. I'll content myself with stating the obvious inarguables. Both are works of the imagination, and both try to create worlds which do not exist, cannot exist, or do not exist yet. There is a difference, of course, but you can draw your own borderline, if you want. And if you try, you may find that it's a very squiggly border indeed. Alien, for instance, is a horror movie, even though it is more firmly grounded in scientific projection than Star Wars. Star Wars is a science fiction film, although we must recognize the fact that it's SF of the E.E. Doc Smith Murray Leinster whack-and-slash school, an outer space western just overflowing with pioneer spirit. Somewhere in between these two, in a buffer zone that has been little used by the movies, are works that seem to combine science fiction and fantasy in a non-threatening way. Close Encounters of the Third Kind, for instance. With such a number of divisions, and any dedicated science fiction or fantasy fan could offer a dozen more, ranging from utopian fiction, negative utopian fiction, sword and sorcery, heroic fantasy, future history, and on into the sunset, you can see why I don't want to open this particular door any wider than I have to. Let me, instead of defining, offer a couple of examples, and then we'll move along. And what better example than Donovan's Brain? Horror fiction doesn't necessarily have to be non-scientific. Kurt Siodmak's novel Donovan's Brain moves from a scientific basis to outright horror, as did Alien. It was adapted 3 times for the screen, and all versions enjoyed fair popular success. Both the novel and the films focus on a scientist who, if not quite mad, is certainly operating at the far borders of rationality. Thus, we can place him in a direct line of descent from the original Mad Lab's proprietor, Victor Frankenstein. And on back to Faust, Daedalus, Prometheus, Pandora, a genealogy leading straight back into the mouth of hell if ever there was one. This scientist has been experimenting with a technique designed to keep the brain alive after the body has died, specifically in a tank filled with an electrically charged saline solution. In the course of the novel, the private plane of W.D. Donovan, a rich and domineering millionaire, crashes near the scientist's desert lab. Recognizing the knock of opportunity, the scientist removes the dying millionaire's skull and pops Donovan's brain into his tank. So far, so good. This story has elements of both horror and science fiction. At this point, it could go either way, depending on Siodmak's handling of the subject. One of the earlier versions of the film tips its hand almost at once. The removal operation takes place in a howling thunderstorm, and the scientist's Arizona laboratory looks more like Baskerville Hall. And none of the films is up to the tale of mounting terror Siodmak tells in his careful, rational prose. The operation is a success. The brain is alive, and possibly even thinking in its tank of cloudy liquid. The problem now becomes one of communication. The scientist begins trying to contact the brain by means of telepathy, and finally succeeds. In a half-trance, he writes the name W.D. Donovan 3 or 4 times on a scrap of paper, and comparison shows that his signature is interchangeable with that of the millionaire. In its tank, Donovan's brain begins to change and mutate. It grows stronger, more able to dominate our young hero. He begins to do Donovan's bidding, said bidding all revolving around Donovan's psychopathic determination to make sure the right person inherits his fortune. The scientist begins to experience the frailties of Donovan's physical body, now moldering in an unmarked grave, low back pain, a decided limp. As the story builds to his climax, Donovan tries to use the scientist to run down a little girl who stands in the way of his implacable, monstrous will. In one of its film incarnations, the beautiful young wife, no comparable creature exists inside Mac's novel, rigs up lightning rods, which zap the brain in its tank. At the end of the book, the scientist attacks the tank with an axe, resisting the endless undertow of Donovan's will by reciting a simple yet haunting mnemonic phrase. He thrusts his fists against the posts and still insists he sees the ghosts. The glass shatters, the saline solution pours out, and the loathsome pulsing brain is left to die like a slug on the laboratory floor. Side Mac is a fine thinker and an okay writer. The flow of his speculative ideas in Donovan's brain is as exciting to follow as the flow of ideas in a novel by Isaac Asimov or Arthur C. Clarke, or my personal favorite in the field, the late John Wyndham. But none of those esteemed gentlemen has ever written a novel quite like Donovan's brain. In fact, no one has. The final tip-off comes at the very end of the book, when Donovan's nephew, or perhaps it was his bastard son, I'll be damned if I can remember which, is hanged for murder. You can see why Donovan liked the kid enough to want to leave him his money, I think. Just a chip off the old block. Three times, the scaffold's trap door refuses to open when the switch is thrown, and the narrator speculates that Donovan's spirit still remains, indomitable, implacable, and hungry. For all its scientific trappings, Donovan's brain is as much a horror story as M.R. James's Casting the Runes, or H.P. Lovecraft's nominal science fiction tale, The Color Out of Space. Now, let's take another story. This one an oral tale of the sort that never has to be written down. It is simply passed mouth to mouth, usually around Boy Scout or Girl Scout campfires after the sun has gone down and marshmallows have been poked onto green sticks to roast above the coals. You've heard it, I guess. But instead of summarizing it, I'd like to tell it as I originally heard it, gape-mouthed with terror, as the sun went down behind the vacant lot in Stratford where we used to play scratch baseball when there were enough guys around to make up two teams. Here is the most basic horror story I know. This guy and his girl go out on a date, you know, and they go parking up on Lover's Lane. So anyway, while they're driving up there, the radio breaks in with this bulletin. The guy says this dangerous homicidal maniac named The Hook has just escaped from the Sunnydale Asylum for the criminally insane. They call him The Hook because that's what he's got instead of a right hand. This razor-sharp hook. And he used to hang around these Lover's Lanes, you know, and he'd catch these people making out and cut their heads off with The Hook. He could do that because it was so sharp, you know. And when they caught him, they found like 15 or 20 heads in his refrigerator. So the news guy says to be on the lookout for any guy with a hook instead of a hand and to stay away from any dark, lonely spots where people go to, you know, get it on. So the girl says, let's go home, okay? And the guy, he's this real big guy, you know, with muscles on his muscles. He says, I'm not scared of that guy. He's probably miles from here anyway. So she goes, come on, Louie, I'm scared. Sunnydale Asylum isn't that far from here. Let's go back to my house. I'll make popcorn and we can watch TV. But the guy won't listen to her. And pretty soon they're up on the Outlook, parked at the end of the road, making out like banditos. But she keeps saying she wants to go home because they're the only car there, you know. That stuff about the hook scared away everybody else. But he keeps saying, come on, don't be such a chicken. There's nothing to be afraid of. And if there was, I'd protect you. Stuff like that. So they keep making out for a while, and then she hears a noise, like a breaking branch or something, like someone is out there in the woods creeping up on them. So then she gets real upset, hysterical, crying everything like girls do. She's begging the guy to take her home. The guy keeps saying he doesn't hear anything at all, but she looks up in the rearview mirror and thinks she sees someone all hunkered down at the back of the car, just peeking in at them and grinning.
She says if he doesn't take her home, she's never going to go out parking with him again and all that happy crappy. So finally he starts up the car and really peels out because he's so jacked off at her. In fact, he just about cracks them up. So anyway, they get home, you know, and the guy goes around to open her door for her. And when he gets there, he just stands there, turning as white as a sheet. And his eyes are getting so big, you'd think they was going to fall out on his shoes. She says, "Louis, what's wrong?" And he just faints dead away right there on the sidewalk. She gets out to see what's wrong. And when she slams the car door, she hears this funny clinking sound and turns around to see what it is. And there, hanging from the door handle, is this razor-sharp hook.
The story of The Hook is a simple, brutal classic of horror. It offers no characterization, no theme, no particular artifice. It does not aspire to symbolic beauty or try to summarize the times, the mind, or the human spirit. To find these things, we must go to literature, perhaps to Flannery O'Connor's story, A Good Man is Hard to Find, which is very much like the story of The Hook in its plot and construction. No, the story of The Hook exists for one reason and one reason alone, to scare the shit out of little kids after the sun goes down. One could jigger the story of The Hook to make him, it, a creature from outer space. And you could attribute this creature's ability to travel across the parsecs to a photon drive or a warp drive. You could make it a creature from an alternate Earth, a la Clifford D.C. Mac. But none of these SF conventions would turn the story of The Hook into science fiction. It's a flesh crawler pure and simple. And in its direct point-to-point progress, its brevity, and its use of story only as a means to get to the effect in the last sentence, it is remarkably similar to John Carpenter's Halloween. "It was the bogeyman," Jamie Lee Curtis says at the end of that film. "As a matter of fact," Donald Pleasance agrees softly, "it was. Or the fog." Both of these movies are extremely frightening, but the story of The Hook was there first. The point seems to be that horror simply is, exclusive of definition or rationalization. In a Newsweek cover story titled Hollywood's Scary Summer, referring to the summer of 1979, the summer of Phantasm, Prophecy, Dawn of the Dead, Nightwing, and Alien, the writer said that during Alien's big scary scenes, the audience seemed more apt to moan with revulsion than to scream with terror. The truth of this can't be argued. It's bad enough to see a gelatinous crab thing spread over some fellow's face, but the infamous chestburster scene which follows is a quantum leap and grew. And it happens at the dinner table yet. It's enough to put you off your popcorn. The closest I want to come to definition or rationalization is to suggest that the genre exists on three more or less separate levels, each one a little less fine than the one before it. The finest emotion is terror, that emotion which is called up in the tale of The Hook and also in that hoary old classic, The Monkey's Paw. We actually see nothing outright nasty in either story. In one we have the hook, and in the other there is the paw, which, dried and mummified, can surely be no worse than those plastic dog turds on sale at any novelty shop. It's what the mind sees that makes these stories quintessential tales of terror. It is the unpleasant speculation called to mind when the knocking on the door begins in the latter story and the grief-stricken old woman rushes to answer it. Nothing is there but the wind when she finally throws the door open. But what, the mind wonders, might have been there if her husband had been a little slower on the draw with that third wish. As a kid, I cut my teeth on William M. Gaines's horror comics, The Haunt of Fear, Tales from the Crypt, The Vault of Horror, plus all the Gaines imitators. But like a good Elvis record, the Gaines magazines were often imitated, never duplicated. Those horror comics of the 50s still sum up for me the epitome of horror, that emotion of fear that underlies terror, an emotion which is slightly less fine because it is not entirely of the mind. Horror also invites a physical reaction by showing us something which is physically wrong. One typical EC screamer goes like this. The hero's wife and her boyfriend determine to do away with the hero so they can run away together and get married. In almost all the weird comics of the 50s, the women are seen as slightly overripe, enticingly fleshy and sexual, but ultimately evil. Castrating, murdering bitches who, like the trapdoor spider, feel an almost instinctual need to follow intercourse with cannibalism. These two heels, who might have stepped whole and breathing from a James M. Cain novel, take the poor slob of a husband for a ride, and the boyfriend puts a bullet between his eyes. They wire a cement block to the corpse's leg and toss him over a bridge into the river. 2 or 3 weeks later, our hero, a living corpse, emerges from the river, rotted and eaten by the fish. He shambles after wifey and her friend, and not to invite them back to his place for a few drinks either, one feels. One piece of dialogue from this story which I've never forgotten is, "I am coming, Marie, but I have to come slowly, because little pieces of me keep falling off." In The Monkey's Paw, the imagination alone is stimulated. The reader does the job on himself. In the horror comics, as well as the horror pulps of the years 1930 through 1955, the viscera are also engaged. As we have already pointed out, the old man in The Monkey's Paw is able to wish the dreadful apparition away before his frenzied wife can get the door open. In Tales from the Crypt, the thing from beyond the grave is still there when the door is thrown wide, big as life and twice as ugly. Terror is the sound of the old man's continuing pulse beat and the telltale heart, a quick sound, like a watch wrapped in cotton. Horror is the amorphous but very physical thing in Joseph Payne Brennan's wonderful novella Slime, as it enfolds itself over the body of a screaming dog. No less a writer than Kate Wilhelm, the acclaimed mainstream and science fiction novelist, author of Where Late the Sweet Bird Sang and The Cluiston Test, among others, began her career with a short but gruesomely effective horror novel, a paperback original called The Clone, written in collaboration with Ted Thomas. In this story, an amorphous creature made of almost pure protein, more blob than clone, the science fiction encyclopedia rightly points out, forms in the sewer system of a major city, around a nucleus of half-rotted hamburger yet. It begins to grow, swallowing hundreds of people into its noxious self as it does. In one memorable scene, a little kid is yanked arm first into the drain of the kitchen sink. But there is a third level, that of revulsion. This seems to be where the chestburster from Alien fits. Better, let's take another example from the EC file as an example of the revolting story. Jack Davis's Foul Play from The Crypt of Terror will serve nicely, I think. And if you're sitting in your living room right now, putting away some chips and dip, or maybe some sliced pepperoni on crackers as you read this, maybe you just better put the munchies away for a while, because this one makes the chestburster from Alien look like a scene from The Sound of Music. You'll note that the story lacks any real logic, motivation, or character development, but, as in the tale of The Hook, the story itself is little more than the means to an end, a way of getting to those last three panels. Foul Play is the story of Herbie Satin, pitcher for Bayville's minor league baseball team. Herbie is the apotheosis of the EC villain. He's a totally black character with absolutely no redeeming qualities, the complete monster. He's murderous, conceited, egocentric, willing to go to any lengths to win. He brings out the mob man or mob woman in each of us. We would gladly see Herbie lynched from the nearest apple tree, and never mind the Civil Liberties Union. With his team leading by a single run in the top of the ninth, Herbie gets first base by deliberately allowing himself to be hit by an inside pitch. Although he is big and lumbering, he takes off for second on the very next pitch. Covering second is Central City's saintly slugger, Jerry Deegan. Deegan, we are told, is sure to win the game for the home team in the bottom of the ninth. The evil Herbie Satin slides into second with his spikes up, but saintly Jerry hangs in there and tags Satin out. Jerry is spiked, but his wounds are minor, or so they appear. In fact, Herbius painted his spikes with a deadly fast-acting poison. In Central City's half of the ninth, Jerry comes to the plate with two out and a man in scoring position. It looks pretty good for the home team, guys. Unfortunately, Jerry drops dead at home plate even as the umpire calls strike three. Exit the malefic Herbie Satin, smirking. The Central City team doctor discovers that Jerry has been poisoned. One of the Central City players says grimly, "This is a job for the police." Another responds ominously, "No, wait. Let's take care of him ourselves. Our way." The team sends Herbie a letter, inviting him to the ballpark one night to be presented with a plaque honoring his achievements in baseball. Herbie, apparently as stupid as he is evil, falls for it, and in the next scene we see the Central City Nine on the field. The team doctor is tricked out in umpire's regalia. He is whisking off home plate, which happens to be a human heart. The base paths are intestines. The bases are chunks of the unfortunate Herbie Satin's body. In the penultimate panel, we see that the batter is standing in the box and that instead of a Louisville slugger, he is swinging one of Herbie's severed legs. The pitcher is holding a grotesquely mangled human head and preparing to throw it. The head, from which one eyeball dangles on its stalk, looks as though it's already been hit over the fence for a couple of home runs, although as Davis has drawn it, Jolly Jack Davis, as the fans of the day called him, he now sometimes does covers for TV Guide, one would not expect it to carry so far. It is, in the parlance of baseball players, a dead ball. The Crypt Keeper followed this helping of mayhem with his own conclusions, beginning with the immortal E.C. chuckle.
"Hee-hee! So that's my Yelp yarn for this issue, kiddies. Herbie the pitcher went to pieces that night and was taken out of existence, that is."
As you can see, both The Monkey's Paw and Foul Play are horror stories, but their mode of attack and their ultimate effect are light years apart. You may also have an idea why the comic publishers of America cleaned their own house in the early 50s, before the U.S. Senate decided to do it for them. So, terror on top, horror below it, and lowest of all, the gag reflex of revulsion. My own philosophy as a sometime writer of horror fiction is to recognize these distinctions because they are sometimes useful, but to avoid any preference for one over the other on the grounds that one effect is somehow better than another. The problem with definitions is that they have a way of turning into critical tools, and this sort of criticism, which I would call criticism by rote, seems to me needlessly restrictive and even dangerous. I recognize terror as the finest emotion, used to almost quintessential effect in Robert Wise's film The Haunting, where, as in The Monkey's Paw, we are never allowed to see what is behind the door. And so I will try to terrorize the reader. But if I find I cannot terrify him, her, I will try to horrify. And if I find I cannot horrify, I'll go for the gross out. I'm not proud. When I conceived of the vampire novel, which became Salem's Lot, I decided I wanted to try to use the book partially as a form of literary homage, as Peter Straub has done in Ghost Story, working in the tradition of such classical ghost story writers as Henry James, M.R. James, and Nathaniel Hawthorne. So my novel bears an intentional similarity to Bram Stoker's Dracula, and after a while it began to seem to me what I was doing was playing an interesting, to me at least, game of literary racquetball. Salem's Lot itself was the ball, and Dracula was the wall I kept hitting it against, watching to see how and where it would bounce so I could hit it again. As a matter of fact, it took some pretty interesting bounces, and I ascribe this mostly to the fact that, while my ball existed in the 20th century, my wall was very much a product of the 19th. At the same time, because the vampire story was so much a staple of the EC comics I grew up with, I decided that I would also try to bring in that aspect of the horror story. The scene in Salem's Lot, which works best in the EC tradition, at least as far as I'm concerned, is when the bus driver, Charlie Rhodes, who is a typical EC type rotter in the best Herbie Satin tradition, awakes at midnight and hears someone blowing the horn of his bus. He discovers, after the bus doors have swung shut forever behind him, that his bus is loaded with children, as if for a school run. But they're all vampires. Charlie begins to scream, and perhaps the reader wonders why. After all, they only stopped by for a drink.
Hee-hee.
Some of the scenes from Salem's Lot, which run parallel to scenes from Dracula, are the staking of Susan Norton, corresponding to the staking of Lucy Westenra in Stoker's book, the drinking of the vampire's blood by the priest, Father Callahan. In Dracula, it is Mina Murray Harker who is forced to take the Count's perverse communion as he croons those memorable, chilling lines, "My bountiful wine press for a little while." The burning of Callahan's hand as he tries to enter his church to receive absolution, when in Dracula, Van Helsing touches Mina's forehead with a piece of the host to cleanse her of the Count's unclean touch, it flashes into fire, leaving a terrible scar. And, of course, the band of fearless vampire hunters, which forms in each book. The scenes from Dracula, which I chose to retool for my own book, were the ones which impressed me the most deeply, the ones Stoker seems to have written at fever pitch. There are others, but the one bounce that never made it into the finished book was a play on Stoker's use of rats in Dracula. In Stoker's novel, the fearless vampire hunters, Van Helsing, Jonathan Harker, Dr. Seward, Lord Godalming, and Quincy Morris enter the basement of Carfax, the Count's English house. The Count himself has long since split the scene, but he has left some of his traveling coffins, boxes full of his native earth, and another nasty surprise. Very shortly after the FVHs enter, the basement is crawling with rats. According to the lore, and in his long novel, Stoker marshals a formidable amount of vampire lore, a vampire has the ability to command the lesser animals, cats, rats, weasels, and possibly Republicans. It is Dracula who has sent these rats to give our heroes a hard time. Lord Godalming is ready for this, however. He lets a couple of terriers out of a bag, and they make short work of the Count's rats. I decided I would let Barlow, my version of Count Dracula, also use the rats, and to that end I gave the town of Jerusalem's Lot an open dump, where there are lots of rats. I played on the presence of the rats there several times in the first couple of hundred pages of the novel, and to this day I sometimes get letters asking if I just forgot about the rats or tried to use them to create atmosphere or what. Actually, I used them to create a scene so revolting that my editor at Doubleday, the same Bill Thompson mentioned in the forenote to this volume, suggested strongly that I remove it and substitute something else. After some grousing, I complied with his wishes. In the Doubleday New American Library edition of Salem's Lot, Jimmy Cody, a local doctor, and Mark Petrie, the boy accompanying him, discover that the King Vampire, to use Van Helsing's pungent term, is almost certainly denning in the basement of a local boarding house. Jimmy begins to go downstairs, but the stairs have been cut away and the floor beneath littered with knives pounded through boards. Jimmy Cody dies impaled upon these knives in a scene of what I would call horror, as opposed to terror or revulsion. The scene is a middle of the roader. In the first draft manuscript, however, I had Jimmy go down the stairs and discover, too late, that Barlow had called all the rats from the dump to the cellar of Eva Miller's boarding house. There was a regular hojo for rats down there, and Jimmy Cody became the main course. They attacked Jimmy in their hundreds, and we are treated, if that is the word, to a picture of the good doctor struggling back up the stairs, covered with rats. They are down his shirt, crawling in his hair, biting his neck and arms. When he opens his mouth to yell Mark a warning, one of them runs into his mouth and lodges there, squirming. I was delighted with the scene as written because it gave me a chance to combine Dracula lore and EC lore into one. My editor felt that it was, to put it frankly, out to lunch, and I was eventually persuaded to see it his way. Perhaps he was even right. Rats are nasty little buggers, aren't they? I wrote and published a rat story called Graveyard Shift in Cavalier magazine 4 years prior to Salem's Lot. It was, in fact, the third short story I ever published, and I was uneasy about the similarity between the rats under the old mill in Graveyard Shift and those in the basement of the boarding house in Salem's Lot. As writers near the end of a book, I suspect that they cope with weariness in all sorts of ways, and my response as I neared the end of Salem's Lot was to indulge in this bit of self-plagiarism. And so, even though I suspect there's a disappointed rat fan or two out there, I've got to say I believe Bill Thompson's judgment that the rats in Salem's Lot should simply fade from the scene was the right one. I've tried here to delineate some of the differences between science fiction and horror, science fiction and fantasy, terror and horror, horror and revulsion, more by example than by definition. All of which is very well, but perhaps we ought to examine the emotion of horror a little more closely, not in terms of definition, but in terms of effect. What does horror do? Why do people want to be horrified? Why do they pay to be horrified? Why an Exorcist, a Jaws, an Alien? But before we talk about why people crave the effect, maybe we ought to spend a little time thinking about components. And if we do not choose to define horror itself, we can at least examine the elements and perhaps draw some conclusions from them. 2. Horror movies and horror novels have always been popular, but every 10 or 20 years they seem to enjoy a cycle of increased popularity and visibility. These periods almost always seem to coincide with periods of fairly serious economic and/or political strain. And the books and films seem to reflect those free-floating anxieties, for want of a better term, which accompany such serious but not mortal dislocations. They have done less well in periods when the American people have been faced with outright examples of horror in their own lives. Horror went through a boom period in the 1930s, when people hard-pressed by the Depression weren't ponying up at the box office to see 100 Busby Berkeley girls dancing to the tune of "We're in the Money." They were perhaps releasing their anxieties in another way, by watching Boris Karloff shamble across the moors in Frankenstein, or Bela Lugosi creep through the dark with his cape up over his mouth in Dracula. The 30s also marked the rise of the so-called shudder pulps, which encompassed everything from Weird Tales to Black Mask. We find few horror movies or novels of note in the 1940s, and the one great magazine of fantasy which debuted in that decade, Unknown, did not survive for long. The great Universal Studios monsters of the Depression days, Frankenstein's Monster, The Wolfman, The Mummy, and The Count, were dying in that particularly messy and embarrassing way that the movies seem to reserve for the terminally ill. Instead of being retired with honors and decently interred in the moldy soil of their European churchyards, Hollywood decided to play them for laughs, squeezing every last quarter and dime admission possible out of the poor old things before letting them go. Hence, Abbott and Costello met the monsters, as did the Bowery Boys, not to mention those lovable-eye boinkers and headknockers, the Three Stooges. In the 40s, the monsters themselves became stooges. Years later, in another post-war period, Mel Brooks would give us his version of Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, Young Frankenstein, starring Gene Wilder and Marty Feldman instead of Bud Abbott and Lou Costello. The eclipse of horror and fiction that began in 1939 lasted for 25 years. Oh, an occasional novel such as Richard Matheson's Shrinking Man or William Sloane's Edge of Running Water would pop up, reminding us that the genre was still there. Although even Matheson's Grim Man Against Giant Spider Tale, a horror story if there ever was one, was touted as science fiction. But the idea of a best-selling horror novel would have been laughed out of court along Publisher's Row. As with the movies, the golden age of weird fiction had passed in the 30s when Weird Tales was at the peak of its influence and quality, not to mention its circulation, publishing the fiction of Clark Ashton Smith, the young Robert Bloch, Dr. David H. Keller, and, of course, the 20th century horror story's dark and baroque prince, H.P. Lovecraft. I will not offend those who have followed weird fiction over a span of 50 years by suggesting that horror disappeared in the 1940s. Indeed, it did not. Arkham House had then been founded by the late August Derleth, and Arkham published what I regard as its most important works in the period 1939 through 1960, works including Lovecraft's The Outsider and Beyond the Wall of Sleep, Henry S. Whitehead's Jumbie, The Opener of the Way, and Pleasant Dreams by Robert Bloch, and Ray Bradbury's Dark Carnival, a marvelous and terrifying collection of a darker world just beyond the threshold of this one. But Lovecraft was dead before Pearl Harbor. Bradbury would turn his hand more and more often to his own lyric blend of science fiction and fantasy, and it was only after he did so that his work began to be accepted by such mainstream magazines as Collier's and the Saturday Evening Post. Robert Bloch had begun to write his suspense stories, using what he had learned in his first two decades as a writer to create a powerful series of offbeat novels, which are only surpassed by the novels of Cornell Woolrich. During and after the war years, horror fiction was in decline. The age did not like it. It was a period of rapid scientific development and rationalism. They grow very well in a war atmosphere, thanks, and it became a period which is now thought of by fans and writers alike as the golden age of science fiction. While Weird Tales plugged grimly along, holding its own but hardly reaping millions, it would fold in the mid-50s after a downsizing from its original gaudy pulp size to a digest form failed to effect a cure for its ailing circulation. The SF market boomed, spawning a dozen well-remembered pulps and making names such as Heinlein, Asimov, Campbell, and Del Rey, if not household words, at least familiar and exciting to an ever-growing community of fans dedicated to the proposition of the rocket ship, the space station, and the ever-popular death ray. So horror languished in the dungeon until 1955 or so, rattling its chains once in a while but causing no great stir. It was around that time that two men named Samuel Z. Arkoff and James H. Nicholson stumbled downstairs and discovered a money machine rusting away unnoticed in that particular dungeon. Originally film distributors, Arkoff and Nicholson decided that since there was an acute shortage of B-pictures in the early 50s, they would make their own. Insiders predicted speedy economic ruin for the entrepreneurs. They were told they were setting to sea in a lead sailboat. This was the age of TV. The insiders had seen the future, and it belonged to Dagmar and Richard Diamond, private detective. The consensus among those who cared at all, and there weren't many, was that Arkoff and Nicholson would lose their shirts very quickly. But during the 25 years that the company they formed, American International Pictures, has been around, it's now Arkoff alone. James Nicholson died several years ago. It has been the only major American film company to show a consistent profit year in and year out. AIP has made a great variety of films, but all of them have taken dead aim on the youth market. The company's pictures include such dubious classics as Boxcar Bertha, Bloody Mama, Dragstrip Girl, The Trip, Dillinger, and the immortal Beach Blanket Bingo. But their greatest success was with horror films. What elements made these AIP films schlock classics? They were simple, shot in a hurry, and so amateurish that one can sometimes see the shadow of a boom mic in the shot or catch the gleam of an air tank inside the monster suit of an underwater creature, as in The Attack of the Giant Leeches. Arkoff himself recalls that they rarely began with a completed script or even a coherent screen treatment. Often money was committed to projects on the basis of a title that sounded commercial, such as Terror from the Year 5000 or The Brain Eaters, something that would make an eye-catching poster. Whatever the elements were, they worked. 3. Well, let all that go for the moment. Let's talk monsters. Exactly what is a monster? Begin by assuming that the tale of horror, no matter how primitive, is allegorical by its very nature, that it is symbolic. Assume that it is talking to us, like a patient on a psychoanalyst's couch, about one thing while it means another. I'm not saying that horror is consciously allegorical or symbolic. That is to suggest an artfulness that few writers of horror fiction or directors of horror films aspire to. There has recently been a retrospective of AIP movies in New York, 1979, and the idea of a retrospective suggests art. But at most, they are trash art. The pictures have great nostalgia value, but those searching for culture may look elsewhere. To suggest that Roger Corman was unconsciously creating art while on a 4-day shooting schedule and a budget of $10,000 is to suggest the absurd. The element of allegory is there only because it is built in, a given, impossible to escape. Horror appeals to us because it says, in a symbolic way, things we would be afraid to say right out straight, with the bark still on. It offers us a chance to exercise, that's right, not exorcise, but exercise, emotions which society demands we keep closely in hand. The horror film is an invitation to indulge in deviant antisocial behavior by proxy, to commit gratuitous acts of violence, indulge our puerile dreams of power, to give in to our most craven fears. Perhaps more than anything else, the horror story or horror movie says it's okay to join the mob, to become the total tribal being, to destroy the outsider. It has never been done better or more literally than in Shirley Jackson's short story, The Lottery, where the entire concept of the outsider is symbolic, created by nothing more than a black circle colored on a slip of paper. But there is no symbolism in The Rain of Stones, which ends the story. The victim's own child pitches in as the mother dies, screaming, "It's not fair! It's not fair!" Nor is it an accident that the horror story ends so often with an O. Henry twist that leads straight down a mine shaft. When we turn to the creepy movie or the crawly book, we are not wearing our everything works out for the best hats. We're waiting to be told what we so often suspect, that everything is turning to shit. In most cases, the horror story provides ample proof that such is indeed the case. And I don't believe when Catherine Ross falls prey to the Stepford Men's Association at the conclusion of The Stepford Wives, or when the heroic black man is shot dead by the numbnuts sheriff's posse at the end of Night of the Living Dead, that anyone is really surprised. It is, as they say, a part of the game. And monstrosity? What about that part of the game? What sort of handle can we get on that? If we don't define, can we at least exemplify? Here is a fairly explosive package, my friends. What about the freaks in the circus? The carny aberrations observed by the light of naked 100-watt bulbs? What about Cheng and Eng, the famous Siamese twins? A majority of people considered them monstrous in their day, and an even greater number no doubt considered the fact that each had his own married life even more monstrous. America's most mordant and sometimes funniest cartoonist, a fellow named Rodriguez, has rung the changes on the Siamese twin theme in his Aesop Brothers strip in the National Lampoon, where we have our noses rubbed in almost every possible bizarre exigency of life among the mortally attached. The sex lives of, the bathroom functions of, the love lives, the sicknesses. Rodriguez provides everything you ever wondered about in regard to Siamese twins and fulfills your darkest surmises. To say that all of this is in poor taste may be true, but it's still a futile and impotent criticism. The old National Enquirer used to run pictures of car wreck victims and pieces, and dogs munching happily away at severed human heads. But it did a land office business and grew before lapsing back into a quieter current of the American mainstream. And there is life in the old Enquirer yet. I buy it if there's a juicy UFO story or something about Bigfoot, but mostly I only scan it rapidly while in a slow supermarket checkout lane, looking for such endearing lapses of taste as the notorious autopsy photo of Lee Harvey Oswald, or their photo of Elvis Presley in his coffin. Still, it is a far cry from the old mom cooks pet dog and feeds it to the kids days. What about the other carny freaks? Are they classifiable as monstrosities? Dwarfs, midgets, the bearded lady, the fat lady, the human skeleton. At one time or another, most of us have been there, standing on the beaten sawdust-strewn dirt with a chili dog or a paper of sweet cotton candy in one hand, While the barker hucksters us, usually with one sample of these human offshoots standing nearby as a specimen, the fat lady in her pink little girl's tutu, the tattooed man with the tail of a dragon curled around his burly neck like a fabulous hangman's noose, or the man who eats nails and scrap metal and light bulbs. Perhaps not so many of us have surrendered to the urge to cough up the 2 bits or 4 bits or 6 bits to go inside and see them, plus such all-time favorites as the two-headed cow or the baby in a bottle. I have been writing horror stories since I was 8, but have never yet attended a freak show. But most of us have surely felt the impulse. And at some carnivals, the most terrible freak of all is kept out back, kept in darkness like some damned thing from Dante's ninth circle of hell, kept there because his performance was forbidden by law as long ago as 1910, kept in a pit and dressed in a rag. This is the geek, and for an extra buck or two, you could stand at the edge of his pit and watch him bite off the head of a live chicken and then swallow it, even as the decapitated bird fluttered in his hands. There is something so attractive about freaks, yet something so forbidden and appalling, that the one serious effort to use them as the mainspring of a horror picture resulted in the film's quick shelving. The picture was Freaks, a Todd Browning film made in 1932 for MGM. Freaks is the story of Cleopatra, the beautiful acrobat who marries a midget. In the best EC tradition, an EC that was almost 20 years unborn in 1932, she has a heart as black as midnight in a coal mine. It's not the midget she's interested in, it's his money. Like the mate-eating human trapdoor spiders of those comic book stories yet to come, Cleo soon takes up with another man. In this case, it's Hercules, the show's strongman. Like Cleopatra herself, Hercules is at least nominally okay, although it is with the freaks that our sympathies lie. These two heels begin a systematic poisoning program on Cleo's tiny husband. The other freaks discover what is going on and take an almost unspeakable revenge on the pair. Hercules is killed. There is a rumor that, as Browning originally conceived the film, the strongman was to be castrated. And the beautiful Cleopatra is turned into a bird woman, feathered and legless. Browning made the mistake of using real freaks in his film. We may only feel really comfortable with horror as long as we can see the zipper running up the monster's back, when we understand that we are not playing for keepsies. The climax of Freaks, as the living torso and the armless wonder and the Hilton sisters, Siamese twins, among others, slither and flop through the mud after the screaming Cleopatra, was simply too much. Even some of MGM's tame exhibitors flatly refused to show it, and Carlos Clarins reports in his illustrated history of the horror film, Capricorn Books, 1968, that at its one preview in San Diego, a woman ran screaming up the aisle. The film was exhibited, after a fashion, in a version so radically cut that one film critic complained that he had no idea what he was watching. Clarins further reports that the film was banned for 30 years in the UK, the country that has brought us, among other things, Johnny Rotten, Sid Vicious, the sniveling shits, and the charming custom of packy-bashing. Freaks is now sometimes exhibited on PTV stations, and may at this writing have finally become available on videocassettes. But to this day it remains a source of heated discussion, comment, and conjecture among horror fans. And although many have heard of it, surprisingly few have actually seen it. 4. Leaving Freaks entirely out of it for the moment, what else do we consider horrible enough to label with what surely must be the world's oldest pejorative? Well, there are all those bizarre Dick Tracy villains, perhaps best epitomized by Flyface, and there was the archenemy of Don Winslow, the Scorpion, whose face was so horrible that he had to keep it constantly covered, although he would sometimes unveil it to minions who had failed him in some way. Said minions would immediately drop dead of heart attacks, literally scared to death. So far as I know, the horrible secret of the Scorpion's physiognomy was never uncovered. Pardon the pun. But the intrepid Commander Winslow did once succeed in unmasking the Scorpion's daughter, who had the slack, dead face of a corpse. This information was delivered to the breathless reader in italics. The slack, dead face of a corpse, for added emphasis. Perhaps the new generation of comic monsters is best epitomized by those created by Stan Lee's Marvel Comics, where for every superhero, such as Spider-Man or Captain America, there seem to be a dozen freakish aberrations. Dr. Octopus, known to children all over the comic-reading world as Doc Ock, whose arms have been augmented by what appear to be a waving forest of homicidal vacuum cleaner attachments. The Sandman, who is a sort of walking sand dune. The Vulture, Stegron. The Lizard. And, most ominous of all, Dr. Doom, whose appearance has been so badly maimed in his twisted pursuit of forbidden science that he now resembles a great clanking cyborg who wears a green cape, peers through eye holes like the archer's slits in a medieval castle, and who appears to be literally sweating rivets. Superheroes with elements of monstrosity in their makeup seem less enduring. My own favorite, Plastic Man, always accompanied by his wonderfully screwball sidekick, Woozy Winks, just never made it. Reed Richards of the Fantastic Four is a Plastic Man lookalike, and his cohort, Ben Grimm, a.k.a. The Thing, looks like a hardened lava flow, but they are among the few exceptions to the rule. So far, we've talked about carny freaks and the caricatures we sometimes find in the funnies, but let's come a trifle closer to home. You might ask yourself what you consider monstrous or horrible in daily life. You're exempted from this if you're a doctor or a nurse. These people see all the aberrations they can handle. And much the same can be said for policemen and bartenders. But as for the rest of us, take fat. How fat does a person have to be before he or she passes over the line and into a perversion of the human form severe enough to be called monstrosity? Surely it is not the woman who shops Lane Bryant or the fellow who buys his suits in that section of the menswear store reserved for the husky build. Or is it? Has the obese person reached the point of monstrosity when he or she can no longer go to the movies or to a concert because his/her buttocks will no longer fit between the fixed armrests of a single seat? You will understand that I am not talking about how fat is too fat here, either in the medical or aesthetic sense, nor anyone's right to be fat. I am not talking about the lady you glimpsed crossing a country road to get her mail on a summer day, her gigantic butt encased in black slacks, cheeks whacking and wobbling together, belly hanging out of an untucked white blouse like slack dough. I am talking of a point where simple overweight has passed through the outermost checkpoints of normality and has become something that, regardless of morality or immorality, attracts the helpless eye and overwhelms it. I am speculating on your reaction and my own to those human beings so enormous that we wonder about how they may perform acts that we mostly take for granted. Going through a door, sitting down in a car, calling home from a telephone booth, bending over to tie our shoes, taking a shower. You may say to me, Steve, you're just talking carny again. The fat lady and her pink little girl's tutu. Those humongous twins who have been immortalized in the Guinness Book of World Records riding away from the camera that clicked the picture on identical tiny motor scooters, their buttocks sticking out to either side like a dream of gravity and suspension. But in point of fact, I am not talking about such people who, after all, exist in their own world where a different scale is applied to questions of normality. How freakish can you feel, even at 500 pounds, in the company of dwarfs, living torsos, and Siamese twins? Normality is a sociological concept. There's an old joke about two African leaders getting together with JFK for a state meeting and then going home on a plane together. One of them marvels, Kennedy, what a funny name! In the same vein, there is the Twilight Zone episode, Eye of the Beholder, about the horribly ugly woman whose plastic surgery has failed for the umpteenth time, and we only find out at the end of the program that she exists in a future where most people look like grotesquely humanoid pigs. The ugly woman is, by our standards at least, extraordinarily beautiful. I am talking about the fat man or woman in our society, the 400-pound businessman, for example, who routinely buys two seats in tourist when he flies and kicks up the armrest between them. I am talking about the woman who cooks herself four hamburgers for lunch, eats them between eight slices of bread, has a quarter of potato salad on the side topped with sour cream, and follows this repast with half a gallon of Breyer's ice cream spread over the top of a table talk pie like frosting. On a business trip to New York in 1976, I observed a very fat man who had become trapped in a revolving door at the Doubleday Bookshop on Fifth Avenue. Gigantic and sweating in a blue pinstriped suit, he seemed to have been poured into his wedge of the door. The bookshop security guard was joined by a city policeman, and the two of them pushed and grunted until the door began to move again, jerk by jerk. At last, it moved enough to let the gentleman out. I wondered then, and wonder now, if the crowd that gathered to watch this salvage operation was much different from those crowds that form when the Kearney Barker begins his spiel, or when in the original Universal film Frankenstein's monster arose from its laboratory slab and walked. Are fat people monstrous? How about somebody with a hair lip or a large facial birthmark? You couldn't get into any self-respecting carny in the country with one of those two. Too common, so sorry. What about somebody with six fingers on one hand, or both hands, or a total of six toes on both feet? There are a lot of those guys around, too. Or, getting down even further toward your block, USA, what about someone with a really bad case of acne? Of course, ordinary pimples are no big deal. Even the prettiest cheerleader on the squad is apt to get one on her forehead or near one corner of her kissable mouth once in a while. But ordinary fat is no big deal either. I'm talking about the case of acne that has run absolutely apeshit, spreading like something out of a Japanese horror movie, pimple on pimples, and most of them red and suppurating. Like the chest burster in Alien, it's enough to put you off your popcorn. Except this is real. Perhaps I've not touched your idea of monstrosity in real life even yet, and perhaps I won't, but for just a moment, consider such an ordinary thing as left-handedness. Of course, the discrimination against left-handed people is obvious from the start. If you've attended a college or a high school with more modern desks, you know that most of them are built for inhabitants of an exclusively right-handed world. More educational facilities will order a few left-handed desks as a token gesture, but that's all. And during testing or composition situations, lefties are usually segregated on one side of the lecture hall so they will not jog the elbows of their more normal counterparts. But it goes deeper than discrimination. The roots of discrimination spread wide, but the roots of monstrosity spread both wide and deep. Left-handed baseball players are all considered screwballs, whether they are or not. Take, for instance, Bill Lee, late of the Montreal Expos and the Boston Red Sox. Lee was dubbed the Spaceman by his colleagues and is remembered fondly by Boston fans for exhorting those who attended a rally following the Sox's pennant win in 1975 to pick up their trash when they left. Perhaps the strongest proof of his leftiness came when he referred to Red Sox manager Don Zimmer as the designated gerbil. Lee moved to Montreal soon after. The French for left, bastardized from the Latin, is la sinistre, from which comes our word, sinister. According to the old superstition, your right side belongs to God, your left side to that other fellow. Southpaws have always been suspect. My mother was a lefty, and as a schoolgirl, so she told my brother and me, the teacher would wrap her left hand smartly with a ruler to make her change her pen to her right hand. When the teacher left, she would switch the pen back again, of course, because with her right hand she could make only large, childish scrawls. The fate of most of us when we try to write with what New Englanders call the dumb hand. A few of us, such as Bramwell Bronte, the gifted brother of Charlotte and Emily, can write clearly and well with either hand. Bramwell Bronte was, in fact, so ambidextrous that he could write two different letters to two different people at the same time. We might reasonably wonder if such an ability qualifies as monstrosity or genius. In fact, almost every physical and mental human aberration has been at some point in history, or is now, considered monstrous. A complete list would include widow's peaks, once considered a reliable sign that a man was a sorcerer, moles on the female body, supposed to be witches' teats, and extreme schizophrenia, which on occasion has caused the afflicted to be canonized by one church or another. Monstrosity fascinates us because it appeals to the conservative Republican in a three-piece suit who resides within all of us. We love and need the concept of monstrosity because it is a reaffirmation of the order we all crave as human beings. And let me further suggest that it is not the physical or mental aberration in itself which horrifies us, but rather the lack of order which these aberrations seem to imply. The late John Wyndham, perhaps the best writer of science fiction that England has ever produced, summarized the idea in his novel The Chrysalids, published as Rebirth in America. It is a story that considers the ideas of mutation and deviation more brilliantly than any other novel written in English since World War II, I think. A series of plaques in the home of the novel's young protagonist offer stern counsel. Only the image of God is man. Keep pure the stock of the Lord. In purity our salvation. Blessed is the norm. And most telling of all, watch thou for the mutant. After all, when we discuss monstrosity, we are expressing our faith and belief in the norm and watching for the mutant. The writer of horror fiction is neither more nor less than an agent of the status quo. 5. Having said all that, let's now return to the American international pictures of the 1950s. In a little while, we'll talk about the allegorical qualities of these films. You there in the back row, stop laughing or leave the room. But for now, let's stick to the idea of monstrosity. And if we touch allegory at all, we'll touch it only lightly, by suggesting some of the things films were not. Although they came along at the same time rock and roll broke the race barrier, and although they appealed to the same fledgling boppers, it's interesting to notice the sort of things that are altogether absent, at least in terms of real monstrosity. We've noted already that the AIP pictures and those of the other independent film companies that began to imitate AIP gave the movie industry a much-needed shot in the arm during the ho-hum 50s. They gave millions of young viewers something they couldn't get at home on TV, and it gave them a place where they could go and make out in relative comfort. And it was the indies, as Variety calls them, that gave a whole generation of war babies an insatiable jones for the movies, and perhaps prepared the way for the success of such disparate movies as Easy Rider, Jaws, Rocky, The Godfather, and The Exorcist. But where are the monsters? Oh, we've got fake ones by the score. Saucer men, giant leeches, werewolves, mole people, in a Universal picture, and dozens more. But what AIP didn't show as they tested these interesting new waters was anything that smacked of real horror. At least as those war babies understood the term emotionally. That is an important qualification, and I hope you'll come to agree with me that it warrants its italics. These were, we were, children who knew about the psychic distress that came with the bomb, but who had never known any real physical want or deprivation. None of the kids who went to these movies were starving or dying of internal parasites. A few had lost fathers or uncles in the war. Not many. And in the movies themselves, there were no fat kids, no kids with warts or ticks, no kids with pimples, no kids picking their noses and then wiping it on the sun visors of their hot rods, no kids with sexual problems, no kids with any visible physical deformity, not even such a minor one as vision that had been corrected by glasses. All the kids in the AIP horror and beach pictures had 20/20 vision. There might be an endearingly wacky teenager on view, of the sort often played by Nick Adams, a kid who was a bit shorter or did daring kooky things, such as wearing his hat backwards like a baseball catcher, and who had a name like Weirdo or Scooter or Crazy. But that was as far as it ever went. The setting for most of these films was small-town America, the scene the audience could best identify with. but all of these our towns looked eerily as if a eugenics squad had gone by the day before production actually began, removing everyone with a lisp, a birthmark, limp, or potbelly. Everyone, in short, who did not look like Frankie Avalon, Annette Funicello, Robert Young, or Jane Wyatt. Of course, Elijah Cook Jr., who appeared in a great many of these films, has always looked a bit weird, but he always got killed in the first reel, so I feel he really doesn't count. Although both rock and roll and the new youth movies, everything from I Was a Teenage Werewolf to Rebel Without a Cause, burst upon an older generation just beginning to relax enough to translate their war into myth, with all the unpleasant surprise of a mugger leaping out of a privet hedge, both the music and the movies were only pre-shocks of a genuine youthquake to come. Little Richard was certainly unsettling, and Michael Landon, who didn't even have enough school spirit to at least take off his high school jacket before turning into a man-wolf, was also unsettling. But it would still be miles and years to the fish cheer at Woodstock and old Leatherface doing impromptu surgery with his McCulloch in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It was a decade when every parent trembled at the specter of juvenile delinquency, the mythic teenaged hood leaning in the doorway of the candy store there in our town, his hair bejeweled with Vitalis or Brill Cream, a pack of Luckies tucked under the epaulette of his motorcycle jacket, a fresh zit at one corner of his mouth, and a brand new switchblade in his back pocket, waiting for a kid to beat up, a parent to harass and embarrass, a girl to assault, or possibly a dog to rape and then kill, or maybe vice versa. It is a once-dread image, which has James Dean and or Vic Morrow here, wait 20 years, and hey presto, out pops Arthur Fonzarelli. But during the period, the newspapers and magazines of the popular press saw young JDs everywhere, just as these same organs of the Fourth Estate had seen commies everywhere a few years before. Their chain-decked engineer boots and pegged Levi's could be seen, or imagined, on the streets of Oakdale and Pineview and Centerville, in Mundamian, Iowa, and in Lewiston, Maine. The shadow of the dreaded J.D. stretched along. Marlon Brando had been first to give this empty-headed nihilist a voice in a picture called The Wild One. "What are you rebelling against?" the pretty girl asks him. Answers Marlon, "What have you got?" To some fellow in Asher Heights, North Carolina, who had somehow survived 41 missions over Germany in the belly of a bomber and who now only wanted to sell a lot of Buicks with power flight transmissions, that sounded like very bad news indeed. Here was a fellow for whom the JCs held no charms. But as there turned out to be fewer communists and fifth columnists than was at first suspected, the shadow of the dread JD also proved to be rather overrated. In the last analysis, the war babies wanted what their parents wanted. They wanted driver's licenses, jobs in the cities and homes in the suburbs, wives and husbands, insurance, underarm protection, kids, time payments which they would meet, clean streets, clear consciences. They wanted to be good. Years and miles between Senior Glee Club and the SLA, years and miles between our town and the Mekong Delta. And the only known fuzz-tone guitar track in existence was a technical mistake on a Marty Robbins country and western record. They adhered happily to school dress codes. Long sideburns were laughed at in most quarters, and a guy wearing stacked heels or bikini briefs would have been hounded unmercifully as a faggot. Eddie Cochran could sing about those crazy pink-pegged slacks, and kids would buy the records, but not the pants themselves. For the war babies, the norm was blessed. They wanted to be good. They watched for the mutant. Only one aberration per picture was allowed in the early youth cult horror film of the 50s, one mutation. It was the parents who would never believe. It was the kids who wanted to be good who stood watch, most often from those lonely bluffs which overlook our town from the ends of Lover's Lanes. It was the kids who stamped the mutant out, once more making the world safe for country club dances and Hamilton Beach blenders. Horrors in the 50s for the war babies were mostly, except maybe for the psychic strain of waiting for the bomb to fall, mundane horrors. And perhaps a conception of real horror is impossible for people whose bellies are full. The horrors the war babies felt were scale model horrors. And in that light, the movies that really caused AIP to take off, I Was a Teenage Werewolf and I Was a Teenage Frankenstein, become mildly interesting. In Werewolf, Michael Landon plays an attractive but moody high school student with a quick temper. He's basically a good kid, but he's involved in one fight after another. Like David Banner, the Hulk's alter ego on TV, the Landon character actually provokes none of these fights, until it looks as though he will be suspended from school. He goes to see a psychiatrist, Whit Bissell, who also plays the mad descendant of Victor Frankenstein in Teenage Frankenstein, who turns out to be totally evil. Seeing Landon as a throwback to an earlier stage of human development, like back to the alley-oop stage, Bissell uses hypnosis to regress Landon totally, in effect, deliberately making the problem worse instead of trying to cure it. Bissell's experiments succeed beyond his wildest dreams, or worst nightmares, and Landon becomes a ravening werewolf. For a 1957 high school or junior high school kid watching the transformation for the first time, this was bad shit. Landon becomes the fascinating embodiment of everything you're not supposed to do if you want to be good. If you want to get along in school, join the National Honor Society, get your letter, and be accepted by a good college where you can join a frat and drink beer like your old man did. Landon grows hair all over his face, produces long fangs, and begins to drool a substance that looks suspiciously like Burma shave. He peeks at a girl doing exercises on the balance beam all by herself in the gymnasium, and one imagines him smelling like a Randy Polecat who just rolled in a nice fresh pile of coyote shit. No button-down Ivy League shirt with a Fruit Loop on the back here. Here's a fellow who doesn't give a fart in a high wind for the scholastic aptitude tests. He has gone absolutely not ape shit, but wolf shit. Undoubtedly, part of the reason for the movie's meteoric takeoff at the box office had to do with the liberating vicarious feelings the movie allowed these war babies who wanted to be good. When Landon attacks the pretty gymnast in the leotard, he is making a social statement on behalf of those watching. But those watching also react in horror, because on the psychological level, the picture is a series of object lessons on how to get along. Everything from shave before you go to school to never exercise in a deserted gym. After all, there are beasts everywhere. 6. If I Was a Teenage Werewolf is, psychologically, that old dream of having your pants fall down when you stand up during homeroom period to salute the flag, taken to its most nightmarish extreme, the ultimate hirsute outsider menacing the peer groups at our town high, then I Was a Teenage Frankenstein is a sick parable of total glandular breakdown. It is a movie for every 15-year-old who ever stood in front of her or his mirror in the morning looking nervously at the fresh pimple that surfaced in the night and realizing glumly that even Stridex-medicated pads weren't going to solve the whole problem no matter what Dick Clark said. I keep coming back to pimples, you may say. You are right. In many ways, I see the horror films of the late 50s and early 60s, up until Psycho, let us say, as paeans to the congested poor. I've suggested that it may be impossible for a people whose bellies are full to feel real horror. Similarly, Americans have had to severely limit their conceptions of physical deformity, and that is why the pimple has played such an important part in the developing psyche of the American teenager. Of course, there's probably a guy out there, a guy born with a congenital birth defect, who's muttering to himself, "Don't talk to me about deformity, you asshole." And it is certainly true that there are Americans with club feet, Americans without noses, amputee Americans, blind Americans. I've always wondered if the blind of America felt discriminated against by that McDonald's jingle that goes, "Keep your eyes on your fries." Besides such cataclysmic physical fuck-ups of God, man, and nature, a few pimples look about as serious as a hangnail. But I should also point out that in America, cataclysmic physical fuck-ups are, so far at least, the exception rather than the rule. Walk down any ordinary street in America and count the serious physical defects you see. If you can walk 3 miles and come up with more than half a dozen, you're beating the average by a good country mile. Look for people under 40 whose teeth have rotted right down to the gum line, children with the bloated bellies of oncoming starvation, folks with smallpox scars, and you will look in vain. You'll not find folks in the AMP with running sores on their faces or untreated ulcers on their arms and legs. If you set up a head inspection station at the corner of Broad and Main, you could check 100 heads and come up with only 4 or 5 really lively colonies of head lice. Incidents of these and other ailments rise in white rural areas and in the inner cities, but in the towns and suburbs of America, most people are looking good. The proliferation of self-help courses, the growing cult of personal development, I'm going to be more assertive, if that's all right with you, as Irma Bombeck says, and the increasingly widespread hobby of naval contemplation are all signs that, for the time being, great numbers of Americans have taken care of the nitty-gritty realities of life as it is for most of the world, the survival trip. I can't imagine anyone with a severe nutritional deficiency caring much about I'm okay, you're okay, or anyone trying to scratch out a subsistence-level existence for himself, his wife, and his 8 kids, giving much of a toot about Werner Erhard's Est course or Rolfing. Such things are for rich folks. Recently, Joan Didion wrote a book about her own odyssey through the 60s, The White Album. For rich folks, I suppose it's a pretty interesting book, the story of a wealthy white woman who could afford to have her nervous breakdown in Hawaii, the 70s equivalent of worrying over pimples. When the horizons of human experience shrink to HO scale, perspective changes. For the war babies, secure except for the bomb, in a world of 6-month checkups, penicillin, and eternal orthodontics, the pimple became the primary physical deformity with which you were seen on the street or in the halls of your school. Most of the other deformities had been taken care of. And, say, having mentioned orthodontics, I'll add that many kids who had to wear braces during those years of heavy, almost suffocating peer pressure saw them as a kind of deformity. Every now and then you would hear the cry of, "Hey, metal mouth!" in the halls. But most people saw them only as a form of treatment, no more remarkable than a girl with her arm in a sling or a football player wearing an ace bandage on his knee. But for the pimple, there was no cure. And here comes I Was a Teenage Frankenstein. In this film, Whit Bissell assembles the creature played by Gary Conway from the bodies of dead hot rodders. The leftover pieces are fed to the alligators under the house. Of course, we have an idea early on that Bissell himself will end up being munched by the gators, and we are not disappointed. Bissell is a total fiend in this movie, reaching existential heights of villainy. He's crying, even the tear ducts work. You've got a civil tongue in your head, I know you have, because I sewed it back myself. Quoted in An Illustrated History of the Horror Film by Carlos Clarence, New York, Capricorn Books, 1968. But it is the unfortunate Conway who catches the eye and mainsprings the film. Like the villainy of Bissell, the physical deformity of Conway is so awful it becomes almost absurd, and he looks like nothing so much as a high school kid whose acne has run totally wild. His face is a lumpy bas-relief map of mountainous terrain from which one shattered eye bugs madly. And yet, somehow, this shambling creature still manages to dig rock and roll, so he can't be all bad, can he? We have met the monster, and as Peter Straw points out in Ghost Story, he is us. We'll have more to say about monstrosity as we go along, and hopefully something of a more profound nature than is contained in the ore we can mine from I Was a Teenage Werewolf and I Was a Teenage Frankenstein. But I think it's important first to establish the fact that, even on their simplest level, these tales of the hook do a number of things without even trying to. Allegory and catharsis are both provided, but only because the creator of horror fiction is above all else an agent of the norm. This is true of horror's more physical side, and we'll find it's also true of works which are more consciously artistic, although when we turn our discussion to the mythic qualities of horror and terror, we may find some rather more disturbing and puzzling associations. But to reach that point, we need to turn our discussion away from film, at least for a while, and to three novels which form most of the base on which the modern horror genre stands.